If there was a vote to see who would be the last speaker in this series, I don't think I got a chance to vote. It's not alphabetical, I can see that, or I wouldn't be here. But whatever the circumstances, no matter how high we've been lifted by the lessons that are preceded, I have been lifted. And whatever the circumstance may be, it's a privilege to be here tonight and to have been here through these days. And I am thankful, as those others who have spoken, to the elders of the congregation and to the two men who work as evangelists here. And a special word of thanks to David, because I think that there has been an enormous amount of work that has gone into it, and I am sure he has had a lot of help from many members of this congregation. And we're thankful to you. We have seen it at the table time. We have seen it at meal time, but those I know are the more visible expressions of your kindness and thoughtfulness. And I want to thank the members of this audience. You've been generous with your words of encouragement. And that helps. Like Brother Robert says, you just don't get too old to need a friend and a word of encouragement. You don't see this, of course, up here on the front seat. And I've experienced it several times in lectureships. One of the other fellows will reach over just before you're supposed to speak and take hold of your hand. Or put his hand on your back. And what that says is, we love you, and you go and do your best, and we're praying for you. It's that kind of spirit that has touched me in the several times that I've been involved in lectureships, and makes me even hesitant and reluctant to leave, because we won't get to see each other in just this context for some long time, and maybe never again. So we're in your debt, and all of us are in debt to the great God we serve. And I'm pleased that there are visitors here tonight, too, and we want to do you good and no harm. The text that speaks about the thorn in the flesh is found in the 12th chapter of 2 Corinthians. I think most of us, I know all of us who preach the gospel, are not a little in awe of the man who wrote this letter. He seems so excellent in his moral life and in his spiritual commitment. He has such a focus about him, such a clearly defined passion that just goes in one direction. And he intimidates us, truly, not his intention, and then stirs us to try more earnestly. The thing about 2 Corinthians and the Apostle Paul is that he sort of pulls back the ordinary restraints and gives us a view of the pain and the anxiety and the perplexity that has gone on beneath a surface that to us at other times seems so serene. His other writings do not reveal it, not even Philippians, which is a letter written to some of the closest friends he had, reveals this. You see the aching, breaking heart of someone whose passion, not just for people he loved because of association with them, but who had a passion for every man and every woman in the world. And such a hunger to reach them with the gospel that he was constantly dissatisfied that there was some other place in the world that did not know. And so his restless feet kept driving him from this place to the other, always struggling to find the place where no one had preached of Jesus. When he comes to the 11th chapter, he's trying to make a case against some teachers who have come into the Corinthian church and have said that he was really not an apostle. That he was just acting a part. And so they tried to attenuate the relationship that these Christians had with Paul, but that wasn't what was critical with the apostle. What was critical with the apostle was that they were going to be separated from the word he had preached and from the God he had proclaimed.
He takes a rather unusual approach. He uses a lot of weak arguments. And he says, I'm doing this in a sort of foolish way. You've driven me to it, he said. It's not my inclination to open up and tell you these things. But these men have been making their boast, and so he, in the 11th chapter, talks first of all about his pedigree. And he moves off that and talks about his persecutions and his perils, and finally winds up talking about the pressures that were on him continually. There is not a list of suffering experiences anywhere in the New Testament that will outdo this, save the sufferings of Christ. And so when I read in chapter 12, verse 7, and by reason of the exceeding greatness of the revelations, that I should not be exalted overmuch, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, that I should not be exalted overmuch. Concerning this thing, I besought the Lord three times that it might depart from me, and he has said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Now, he said that because his last argument is to be made in this chapter about weakness. He indicates in the beginning of the chapter that he was carried into the third heaven, which is the place where God is, and that he heard things that men were not allowed to speak, not that they couldn't utter, but he said it's not lawful to speak them. Now, there must be a purpose in this. The Apostle Paul had been given many visions, the preeminent one of the risen Christ, and then the revelation directly from the Son of God of the gospel. He didn't get it from somebody else, he says in the first chapter of Galatians. But of all things, this time he receives a revelation and he's told, you can't utter it. And then after that, because God is concerned that it might cause even the apostle to be exalted overmuch, proud, vain, he gives him a thorn in the flesh. Now, when I read this other list, in labors more abundantly, in prisons more abundantly, in stripes above measure, in deaths often, of the Jews 5 times received I 40 stripes save one, 3 times was I beaten with rods, 1 was I stoned, 3 times I suffered shipwreck, a night and a day have I been in the deep, in journeyings often, in perils of rivers, in perils of robbers, and so on and so on. Luke didn't tell us any of this, and I have a great suspicion it's because not just that the Holy Spirit did not guide him in that direction, but there could have been a restraining hand on his pen from the Apostle Paul. That's a speculation. But what I'm asking tonight as I begin this lesson, what is this thorn? I tell you, it's going to have to be something, or he wouldn't even notice it, given all the other things that were happening to him. So that's his argument, he says. My final argument is, this is my weakness. I was given a thorn in the flesh. What was this thorn? That's where every expositor begins. It's where all the commentaries began, and they don't seem to know. I want to say, first of all,
And you'll find in the footnote in the American Standard Version, I don't know of any version that necessarily uses this. But we think of a thorn as a irritating little sticker that bothers us every time something touches that part of our hand where it's embedded. And it's sort of a nuisance. The word in the Greek text means a stake, which says that whatever it is not some sort of unceasing nuisance. It is a constant source of so profound a pain that when compared to these other things that Paul has enumerated, it stands above. I don't know for sure what it is. But it was given to him nearly 14 years before this letter was written, and if I can judge in some broad terms when that might be, I suspect that 2 Corinthians was written about 53 or 54 A.D. We all decide that from the presence of Gallio in Corinth when Paul visited there, and therefore we get some idea when 1 Corinthians was written, and then 2 Corinthians comes sometime after that. I'm not sure about the exact date, but that means we're casting it back around 39 or 40 A.D., and some have thought it might have taken place during that period of time when he was beaten nearly to death in Lystra on that first preaching journey when he with Barnabas made the first incursion into the Gentile world. I do not know, and no one else knows, when this vision took place. But it was in the early part of his preaching career. He had not suffered a lot of things yet, but he had suffered plenty. In that, he had at the very beginning, when he saw the vision on the road, and knew he was cut to the quick and indicted totally as a murderer and a persecutor and a man who had looked into the eyes of people who were the followers of the Son of God and the servants of the living God, and he had compelled them to blaspheme. And all of that he knew in that moment when he saw the risen Lord. And at that moment, because he was the man he was, and all the anguish of it was experienced in one fell swoop, he said, "Lord, what would you have me to do?" He swallowed it whole. And he took his medicine in Damascus, where they would have ordinarily received him as plenipotential. You know, this man has come from the priests in Jerusalem. We will show him due deference. We will accept his warrants, and we'll give him whatever he wants. He can have the run of the place. But instead, now that he comes into the city as a servant of Jesus Christ, they are out to get him, his Jewish opponents, and they're watching the gate, and he has the humiliation of having to be let down through an apartment that was on the wall in a basket. He said, "Now that's what kind of a big man I am." And then he came back to Jerusalem, where I have the strongest feeling. He felt that surely in the place where they had honored and respected him so, they would give him a hearing. They would sit down, perhaps in the Sanhedrin, and say, "We want to hear everything. This is unusual. We are shocked. We are surprised. But Paul, we have loved you. We have loved you and respected you for so long that we want to hear the reasons why this great change has taken place." That never occurred. Plots were made by Grecian Jews in the city of Jerusalem that were so serious that the brethren had to spirit him out. The Lord told him to get out. "They won't listen to you." That was a hard message. And in that setting, somewhere along the way, he received this thorn in the flesh. Was it a grievous, gruesome physical illness? Something dragging him down, inhibiting his work to reach lost people? I cannot imagine that anything that we can describe as a thorn in the flesh to the Apostle Paul was not something that was a barrier to his work, because that was the only thing there was to him. There must have been something about it that was making it extremely difficult for him to achieve his single heart's ambition to tell the world about Jesus Christ. Some have said it was eye disease, others headache, malaria, epilepsy, nervous disorder. Eye disease probably is the best guess. Galatians chapter 4, 13 to 15. You know that I preached the gospel to you because of an affliction. And you didn't despise me for it. You didn't cast me out for it. In fact, you said you would have taken out your own eyes and given them to me. That seems to be a clue. And then he concludes the letter by observing that. See with what big letters, what large letters I write. And so an amanuensis doubtless wrote the rest, and Paul puts in his own big letters, and we say, well, that's probably the case. The only thing that makes me wonder about that is in his last epistle, 2 Timothy 4, verse 13, he says to Timothy, bring the books and the parchments. He can read. He can read. But that might be the case. Was it some unyielding temptation? Luther and Calvin said a spiritual temptation. Augustine and Aquinas said a carnal temptation. That is to say, something inside of him that wanted to answer to some carnal appeal. And he had to fight it every day. It was something that was, it was a specter haunting him while he wanted to go out and his mind was set on preaching the gospel and doing the work of the kingdom of God. That thing was just there, constantly burdening him. Perhaps. Was it the rejection of Christ by his people? That was a burden to Paul. You could not have expected to be otherwise. It hurt him that they would not listen. That they had such a madness against him that they would not even sit down and let him tell them about it. Romans chapter 9. He said, I could wish myself anathema from Christ for the sake of my people. And in chapter 10, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they may be saved. He longed for that with a desperate passion. Or perhaps it was the burden of the churches. He speaks of it in chapter 11, the pressure from all the churches. His concern for them, and I can tell you why he was concerned, because he was an apostle and because the word of God was coming through him. And more than that, he was personally responsible for the planting of many of these churches. And they knew him. And he had his heart in it. And he could not just cut himself loose emotionally from these people and say, well, let them see to themselves. He had a father's concern. Here's a man who was a bachelor all his life, and yet he was one of the most passionate fathers you ever saw. Let it never be said that men who never marry cannot be men who are tutors and mentors and instructors of others, and who, as Paul once said to the church at Thessalonica, I cared for you like a nurse cares for her own child. And that would be a burden, especially when ungodly teachers came in, first into the church of Galatia, then they got up to Corinth and probably were on the horizon at Philippi when he's in prison and can't do a thing in the world about it in terms of his personal presence. Or it may have been, as some have suggested, I believe Brother Ken Chumley suggested this in a lecture that he made some years ago, all these things, his weaknesses, the things that burdened him, all these things might be the case. I said before I began this long list that I wasn't sure, so I've telegraphed the thing. But this thorn was of such a nature that it moved Paul to plead with God three times to release him from it. I would suspect that there are intervening periods between these appeals. You don't go before God and urgently appeal to him for release and then wait one day and assault his throne again. But he urgently wants, you know he wants this desperately, and he seeks for relief. All of us, I'm sure, can identify with a thorn in the flesh that is anguishing and painful and seems always to be there, and it's beyond our control, and for all that we try to change the circumstances, they're not changeable. And so we plead to God for help. It may be some painfully disabling malady. I'm not talking about a occasional headache.
I'm talking about something that disables and keeps you from being what you want to be. What you could be for the Lord's sake. Or it might be some deep, illicit desire that somewhere down in your soul sits to respond to the carnal appeal of the world around. And you hate it. And you wish it would go away and that you didn't have to fight every day with that sort of thing. And yet it continues. Or it may be some personal relationship. We can easily imagine a marriage where a spouse is the source of heartache. A spouse that is bitter. A spouse that is harsh. A spouse that is unkind. A spouse that is unheeding any appeal. And every day you must live in an intimate contact with this individual and try to do what is right yourself without any encouragement from them. Indeed, only the constant impulse to respond in kind. And you wish and long so much as you think about what might be achieved in this family if only these two people who were made one by God could be truly one. And you try your best to be happy and generous and godly and kind and loving and long-suffering, and yet in spite of all you do, things don't change. I can imagine it as tonight Brother Hall has spoken about parent and child relationships. Really painful. And fellow Christians, people we live with in a local church, that seem to be our nemesis. They seem dedicated to creating misery in our lives, putting us down, demeaning us, diminishing us in some way. And we feel that continually. And we don't want to get in a mood like that. We don't want to be retaliatory. We don't like to flash something back, here's something in your face for that. We don't want to do that. And yet we're constantly provoked by that. And not only that, we feel diminished within ourselves. And we plead with God for help. Or there are people like Paul's great concern that you just want to be saved so badly that it's in the forefront of your mind continually. It's a burden to you, and yet those people are absolutely unheeding and unconcerned and just reject you out of hand. And it just goes on that way. What we're concerned about tonight is not what this thorn is. That really is rather beside the point. You just put your own thorn in. What we're concerned about tonight is how Paul dealt with it. The first thing that can be said about it, and this is important because it puts him in the class with Job, he did not charge God foolishly. He did not come before God and say, "Don't you want me to do the job you gave me? Why are all these roadblocks being thrown up in front of me? I am here to do the work, and all I'm getting is obstacles. All I'm getting is difficulties. I want to serve you. I want to be all that you want me to be. But how can I do that if I just get trouble, trouble, trouble constantly?" Ever felt that way? There's an edge of bitterness in that. There's an edge of accusation. That if I'm not what I ought to be here, if I'm not all that I ought to be here, it's because of the circumstance into which you put me. Paul never suggested such a thing. What he said was that God had given him. Well, someone said, it doesn't say God had given him that. Well, it's true, it says, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to buffet me.
Now, as I said, I think earlier, I never can remember because I've preached so many places and said so many things, whether I said it during this week or said it some other week, but if it's redundant, you'll be merciful, I know.
The devil never intended to help anybody be humble. It was God overseeing and tending this affair who allowed that to happen because his servant needed something that Satan, not intending, but able to achieve because of the affliction he gave.
And so, in the final analysis, God let it happen for the benefit of his servant. And Paul just said, that's the reason for it. It was done for me.
And I pled for a release from it, and the answer that I got was,
it's not going to be removed.
But the interesting thing is,
and this is true of Job, he turned to God for help.
Because he knew, whatever the circumstance, wherever this came from, it was his Father. It was his Father who could do something about it. And he believed that his Father cared
about that. There was no question. This man knew what had happened to him. He was chief of sinners. And yet God had been merciful to him. I'm telling you, Paul never forgot that. And I want to say something else. Some of us have. I don't know what it is in us. Whether we have sort of diminished what we did before we became Christians, and if we didn't do that, some of us have diminished what we've done since. But somehow or another, there is not that deep wellspring of gratitude rising up from within us that says, oh, I am so grateful. I do not deserve to be here. And I want to tell you that not one of us in this building tonight that deserves to be here. But you've been so good to me. And Paul knew that whatever was happening or might happen in the future would be worked out for his benefit and for the benefit of the cause of Christ. And so he appeals to God for help. Now, I have to admit here some failure in my own life. It's not the only one. I'm not going to tell you all of them. I'll save that for some other time. One interesting thing about this letter that helps us is, and I want to say this about preachers. Sometimes preachers are a little too close-mouthed about their own failures until people who listen to them come to the conclusion that fella never had any problems. Or if he's had them, he's solved them excellently. And people who listen to us with that sort of facade erected come to the conclusion there's surely something wrong with me. I'm not like Brother Earnhardt. He never has those problems. He never wrestles with those things. And here I am wrestling with all these things. There's something badly wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with you. The truth is, the man that's speaking to you got all those challenges too. And it does not hurt every now and then for us to pull back the curtain and say, it's so. Be an encouragement. As Paul says, I've been in trouble and I got comfort and that enables me to comfort you. But at any rate, some of us haven't turned to God. And I've been guilty of that. I mean, I've wandered around and complained and worried and let anxiety seize the high ground. And what I should have been doing was getting on my knees to ask God to help me. And I've repented of that, and I'll probably repent again. And I may have to repent the third time. But I tell you something, I'm trying to do that. What I see here in him. And then the answer was, no. I don't like to get those answers. But sometimes I'm glad. You know, we ought to be glad sometimes when God says to us, when we have prayed so earnestly, no. I met a young lady when I was quite young, and I just thought that the Lord ought to arrange for that young lady to be my wife. I just, in my infinite wisdom and the feelings of the moment, I just thought that was wholly in concord with God's eternal purpose, and all he needed to do was just see that things were carried out. Well, you know, that didn't turn out
And about 10 years ago, I was visiting near where that romance took place, and I found out that she was living with her fourth husband. Well, maybe God is smarter than I thought. And I had to wait until I was 29 years old. And I felt like Abraham, only it wasn't a child I wanted. It wasn't a child I wanted, it was a wife. And through those years, I anguished, not openly, for I had learned that to openly anguish about that subject is to put off all the young ladies within about 500 miles. And so you had best keep that to yourself. The Lord bless me, because he said no. Now, this was not to be my thorn in the flesh. This was not to be the thing that never would be heard. This was not to be that sort of thing. And we're talking tonight about things that just go on and on and on. And in this particular case, Paul found out from God that it's never going to stop. But that's the fourth thing. Paul accepted that and turned what was burdening him into the blessing that God intended to be. My grace is sufficient for you. Here's the principle. My strength is made perfect in weakness. Paul talks about that in the first chapter of 2 Corinthians. I don't know all that was going on, but that's a tough time. Things were about to blow apart in Corinth. He had people running back and forth over there. He may have made a trip himself that we don't know about. And the situation in Ephesus was horrendous. We are not told much more than 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians. I fought with men as beasts at Ephesus. I died daily. But here he speaks more to the point about it. He talks about his afflictions. And he speaks specifically of some of them. Verse 8, "For we would not have you ignorant, brethren, concerning our afflictions which befell us in Asia, that we were weighed down exceedingly beyond our power, insomuch that we despaired even of life. Yes, we ourselves have had the sentence of death within ourselves, that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead." In other words, I was brought so low that I had no resource whatsoever, and I despaired of life. And something in those desperate circumstances came to me that it was God who gives life, and I need to be trusting in Him. And you say, you mean the Apostle Paul, who gave up everything and suffered the loss of all things and counted them but dung? He still needed somehow to understand that God alone must be his resource and his help. Well, that's what this says. And it's well into his work. We don't grow up in a second. We don't grow up suddenly. Spiritual growth takes time, and it happens moment by moment and day by day and week by week and year by year, and it's a growing process all the way through. And even for this great man, it was, I have learned, as he says to the Philippians, in whatever state I am there with, to be content. Some of us want instant spirituality. It's not possible. It's a grueling experience sometimes. It's 40 years slogging through the wilderness, but it works. That's the thing that we need to understand. It works. It works to change and to transform. It works in the case of the Apostle Paul. It works in my case. It works in your case to transform. My strength is made perfect in weakness. I'll tell you why God can't help some of us. He wants to give us many things. In fact, it's more than just wanting to give us something. He wants to make us something, but our hands are already too full. That's the problem. Where is he going to put it? The day has to come when our hands are empty because we recognize we don't have anything that'll deal with this. And then he can fill us full. First we have to be emptied, and then he can fill us. And that, I think, is what the apostle is saying in this particular case. Oh, I like to illustrate it briefly in what he wrote to the Philippians. That was a tough time. He'd spent 2 dumb years. He didn't say that. Down in the prison in Caesarea, because
some Roman procurators either didn't have 1 ounce of courage or were absolutely corrupt. And so he sat and vegetated there while the world went to hell. And he had the message of salvation, and his commission was to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. And he had to sit there. Well, I want to tell you something. He didn't sit there and moan and groan. He preached the gospel to Felix and Drusilla. And he preached the gospel to Herod Agrippa II. And he preached the gospel to Festus. And he preached the gospel to any he could preach. But it was a difficult time. And then he says in desperation, this is not going to work. I appeal to Caesar. So they put him on a boat with a chief captain, and he's on sea, and he gets out there, and what happens? But there's a shipwreck in the middle of the Mediterranean, and now he's laid up on an island among the heathen for all winter long. So that extends the period. No activity, no ability to go. He had written to the Romans, I want to come to you, and then I want to go by you to Spain. I want to go to Spain. And then he gets finally to Rome next spring. And Luke tells us the story. He sat there in custody 2 years, and then the record breaks off. 2 years. I think in the middle of this is when Philippians was written, maybe toward the end of it. And what he tells us in that first chapter is, and here I want to make this point. You know, you and I have our thorns, and all of us have our tough things to deal with. But we just cannot began to think that what we have the right to do is to fall over in some sort of dead faint of self-pity and by our actions act as though God doesn't care about any of us, and it's a tough life, and sometimes you just don't know what's going on, and sometimes you're just miserable and wretched, and it's just time to give up and get in your bed and turn your face to the wall. I won't tell you that I have never had that emotion. I won't even tell you that I've never done it for a little while. Of course I have. But I want to tell you something. That's not good. And it's a slander against the God and the Christ we serve. Paul said, I want to tell you fellas, what's happened up here, they want to know, everybody that knew Paul want to know what's happened now, that he's up there looking in the face of Caesar. Right there where the legions march, where the greatest power on earth is situated. Now what are you going to say? And now what are you going to do up there in your prison cell or in your hired house where they're keeping you or chaining you? What are you going to do now? And he said, I tell you what's happened. These fellows that have to come in here and be chained to me every fourth watch, the Praetorian Guard, the Imperial Guard, the Special Guard to the Caesar, they've got to listen every time somebody comes in here to talk to me about who I am and why I'm here. And the gospel has been preached throughout the Praetorian Guard. Now, most of us would have said, this is a bad place. I'm going to go to bed and cover my head and forget about the whole business. That's a choice. And he still had that thorn in the flesh. And there were bad people in the church at Rome, too, trying to add to his miseries by saying, well, I know you people think that Paul hung the moon. Now, we're a little sick and tired of hearing about what Paul did, what he did, and what he said, and all his preaching. We're tired of that. And so they're out preaching, really being active, want to be evangelistic now, because they want to prove that they can do it better than he can. And he said, to raise up affliction to me in my bonds, they did it of envy and strife. You know what kind of man this was. He said, I'm glad it's being preached. Let me tell you something. That's power. But it doesn't come from people who look to themselves for strength. Because the moment you begin to look to yourself for resources, you become egocentric and man-centered. And that means you will be ultimately weak. But when you accept your weakness, when you empty yourself and look in God's direction and pursue his purpose no matter the circumstance, then there's strength that's in there. Not even death, he said, bothering me. If I die, I'll just magnify Christ in my death. But if I live, it'll be a blessing to you. And so he lived his life. And so he died, so far as we know,
with that thorn still, that stake still embedded, whatever it was. It's wonderful to trust in grace and goodness and mercy and God's wisdom and power to work things out so that we can achieve what we want. You know, we don't know how to pray as we ought. Paul thought what he needed was to get rid of that thorn, and God knew what he needed was to endure it so that he would be brilliantly transformed, honed, and burnished into brightness of the glory of God Himself as a consequence of having to bear this burden. Now, I know it's difficult. Somebody says, how am I going to know if the thorn I've got is that one that can't be removed? Well, you're not going to get a revelation from God about that. And so you probably ought to just keep praying about it. But if it's just never removed, you just accept that. Maybe it will be removed in time. I don't know. But here's the way you deal with it. You deal with it just like Paul did, trusting God, praying to Him, and living life one day at a time. That's all you got anyway. And we need to live life in day-tight compartments. It doesn't do any good to say, I can't, if I have to live with this for another 30 years, I can't do it. Well, you may be dead tomorrow. That'll relieve you. Your old nemesis may be removed who knows where tomorrow. That'll relieve you. But you say, what if it's not done? Well, one day at a time. Quit saying, I can't live 40 years. You only have to live 1 hour with it. That's all you have to do. 1 hour by the grace of God, another hour by the grace of God, another day by the grace of God, another week by the grace of God, another year by the grace of God. And when lived that way, as Jesus has told us, it becomes possible for us to do it. And by deepening our faith, every hour that we live with our thorn, so that the love and power of God may rest upon us, that will require meditation on God's Word, deep meditation, prayer to Him. And it needs an expression of commitment in deeds, not sitting around whining and complaining, but acting, doing the things that we can do, not just in the area of this great test, but in every area. Personal devotion in our families, among our brethren, and among our friends and neighbors and the world. And by knowing, and this is important, by knowing it doesn't make any difference how it looks now, I am on the winning side. And I don't want to be on the other side. I tell you, I'm privileged tonight to have our younger daughter here with her two children, my grandchildren. And one thing that's given me pause many times in my life is the fact that I absolutely cannot act the fool. Paul knew that. He knew people were looking his way. And that if he fell flat on his face, there would be people out there to say, if he can't do it, what's going to happen to us? I cannot do that. Because there are too many others that I might crush by my own weakness. I can't do it. God can help me. And that is what I must do. Doggedness is what we need sometimes. Just doing what is right because it's right. And one of these days, blessed thought, we're going to get to look back on all this.